Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture, and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Atheists, agnostics, long-haired weirdos, short-haired weirdos, vandals.
The government, hug the government, love the government, hug the government, love the government, hug the government.
Welcome to the Politics Podcast, a place for bipartisan, rational, and civil debate on American politics and policy. I'm Michael Baranowski, professor of political science at Northern Kentucky University. I'm joined today by my conservative counterpart, Cleveland area attorney and defender of freedom, Jay Carson.
Good morning, Mike.
Hey, Jay, how are you doing this morning?
I'm doing well. The defending freedom business, it takes a lot out of you. So early Saturday mornings are sometimes tougher than you think they're going to be. But regardless, here I am.
That's good. You know, before we do get started, I want to thank one of our newest supporters. Well, actually, a former supporter, Eric, on Patreon, who very briefly paused his support, and now he's back, and he wrote in to me. He said, yeah, I had to buy a second modem for work, so I couldn't continue to contribute, and I had to cancel my membership. That lasted a week. I just couldn't do it. So I'm back in a smaller capacity, but I got to chip in. I need my politics guys. And Eric's been with us for a while. And it's just, I think it really exemplifies the sort of listeners and supporters that we have. And I just want to thank Eric and everyone out there who is like Eric. And I know there are a bunch of you who make this show possible. So thanks very much. And of course, if you want to become a supporter, when you're a Patreon supporter, you get that second full-length episode every week. You get ad-free versions of all our shows, various other things at different levels of support. You know where to go check it out at this point, patreon.com/politicsguys. And as always, if you would like that bonus show, but you're not in a position financially to be able to support the show, send me an email, mike@politicsguys.com, and I will get you set up with that midweek show. And if a monthly pledge is just too much of a commitment, or you just like to support us on a one-time basis, but you don't want to go through Patreon, we've got PayPal at politicsguys.com/support, and we are also on Venmo at politicsguys. All right, with that, Jay, why don't we kick it off with our, it's probably as a surprise to no one, top story of this week.
Yes, obviously our top story is probably one of the top stories of the last year. And that is the Derek Chauvin verdict. Minneapolis jury convicted Derek Chauvin of on all three counts, second-degree murder, third-degree murder, and manslaughter. And so that in itself, Mike, we could probably take up a show with. But in addition to that, there were some surrounding issues to discuss. One is comments by Maxine Waters prior to the verdict, where she exhorted people that if they didn't get the verdict they wanted, they needed to stay in the streets and get more confrontational. The judge in the Chauvin case denied a motion for mistrial on the basis of that, but indicated that that may well be an issue on appeal. Similarly, but less inflammatorily, I guess, President Biden, before the verdict, made a statement saying, I pray that the jury reaches the right decision. And I think there was no real doubt what Joe Biden thought the right decision was going to be. So there are those issues that I think we should discuss as far as their impact on this case and possible future cases. And then the next step is the Justice Department has announced a sweeping investigation of the Minneapolis Police Department and its use of force, and whether it is acting unconstitutionally, sort of on a habitual pattern by doing this. And then finally, the other piece, if we can get to it, is the police reform legislation. Senator Tim Scott of South Carolina had proposed a bill last year that went nowhere. There is a Democratic alternative at this point. The last we heard is that there were discussions between Tim Scott and Chuck Schumer, seeing if there might be a possibility to come together. But the sticking point seems to be qualified immunity and the extent of qualified immunity for police. So with all that, I guess, you know, I'll pitch it to you, Mike, on initial thoughts just on the verdict. And I always hate to ask this question: did the jury get it right? But your sense, the verdict, did the jury get it right? Does the system work?
Well, I think those are two different questions, but I it seems to me that this
did the system work in this case? I guess that's better, the better way to put it.
That this case was unusual in the sense, and I think telling in the sense that so many police officers actually testified for the prosecution. This wasn't the blue wall went up. There were plenty of cops in Chauvin's own department who said, wow, that was just clearly out of line. And so in a way, you know, I guess we can say that in this instance, it seemed to be pretty clear cut. There was such strong evidence that it seemed that, yeah, I certainly think that the right verdict was reached. But in a way, this is kind of there's a concern because this could potentially strengthen sure, there are some really, really bad apples like Chauvin, who clearly just went beyond the pale, but he was convicted, and so therefore, nothing to see here, folks. Let's kind of move on. We don't have a problem, essentially, you know. And so I think in that sense, I was happy with the verdict. Like I think a lot of people, I think it was the right verdict. But I also am concerned that too many people will use this as an excuse to say, well, you know, if there are bad cops, see, they can be convicted. And my response would be, well, yes, if they do something so incredibly egregious as this, but I've watched a video like so many people of this, just like I watched a video of the Adam Toledo and the young woman in Columbus this week, whose name I'm forgetting at this moment. But those videos, I think, are a lot more commonplace. What we're used to seeing is they're not as clear cut. It's not 9 minutes plus of stepping on someone's neck. It's this sort of boom, boom sort of situation where everything is shaky and unclear, and it's a lot harder to see and understand what's going on. And I think that's a lot more commonplace. And so that's why I think this is maybe a bad case to point to in a sense, because I don't think that most police misconduct looks like this. I think this is so egregious that it's not necessarily representative of some of the stuff, a lot more of the stuff that tends to go on. And that's why I was very glad to see that Attorney General Garland was announcing the first Justice Department investigation in the Biden administration of a police department.
So let's get back to where, as far as police misconduct, and I guess there is a, would you draw a line between police misconduct, bad policing, and criminal conduct? Because I think that's something that, you know, for example, the Justice Department investigation may look at a whole lot of things that are, for example, unconstitutional. Right? Is there overly racial policing? Is there a bias that's apparent? Are that sort of thing? Is force habitually maybe overused? Those are all separate issues from crime of murder.
Sure.
And I guess, you know, to me, it seems that, yes, the facts on this, and I'll give my sort of usual caveat that I'm always hesitant to weigh in on a jury's decision, because necessarily the jury sees it's in some cases much more evidence than we at home see. And they also at the same time see much less evidence than we at home see. So a lot of times it's tough to say exactly, you know, did your jury get it right? Because unless we're watching the trial from start to finish, we don't know what all they saw, heard. We don't know what all. And also we can't ignore other stuff that we saw and heard that the jury would not have seen. All that said, I think the jury got it right, you know, based on everything that I've seen. And you're right. This is a case where the evidence was pretty clear, pretty overwhelming. It was 9 minutes of video. It was dozens of witnesses who actually saw the incident. It was plenty of forensic witnesses. So So yes, this is maybe the easier case, because it is more extreme. But isn't that maybe better, right? In that if you compare to, for example, the Columbus case, there's, you know, we could have a whole show on, is that police misconduct?
Right.
I think there's a good argument to be made that that policeman is a hero. He saved another's life, and, you know, acted quickly. It's a tragedy that, that someone had to die, but, sure. I think there's very much an argument that is not, it's conduct of a completely different, type of character, than, the Chauvin
sure.
case.
And that's why I think it's important to, we tend to focus on discrete incidents and take our sides and so forth, especially when the evidence is not as overwhelmingly clear as it is in as it was in the Chauvin case. But in a case like the Makia Bryant case or something like that, say, well, was this cop a hero or a villain or something like that? Well, that's a tough question. But one thing we do know is that, for instance, in Columbus, Ohio, where this happened, that the data from actually a study that the city commissioned of the police department from 2015 to 2019 showed that blacks in the city accounted for about half of all use of force incidents, and while making up only 28% of the city's population. Now that's kind of pulling back and looking at a broader scope, and that's the sort of thing that these Justice Department investigations take a look at. And I think that's a right. that's a very healthy sort of thing. And I should point out that you know these only came about because of the 1994 crime bill, which a lot of people had issues with, and I think rightly so. But this is one, I think, good thing that came out of this crime bill, because it basically empowered the Justice Department to go ahead and sue local governments for these unconstitutional practices. And you know, we've seen a ton of these consent decrees since then, which is basically where they kind of settle, right, with the right. government. There are also things called collaborative agreements, which are kind of a different, less restrictive version of that. I mean, there was one in Cincinnati in 2002, where I'm at, in Cleveland. There's one from 2015.
There's one in Cleveland, yeah, for a while.
All kinds of, you know, a lot of cities. And I think the evidence that we that has been collected from researchers on this has demonstrated, at least certainly to my satisfaction, that this has led, these decrees, these agreements have led to better policing without the sort of rise in crime that a lot of people feared would come after this. And so I think they're generally speaking a good thing, and that's why I was glad to see this. I mean, there were like three of them in the Bush administration. There were 15 consent decrees under Obama. Then Jeff Sessions becomes attorney general under the Trump administration, and these things basically just stop. And so I'm glad to see this coming back, because I think it's a very important
Although prior ones that were in place still remained in place.
Exactly. But those investigations, basically the, you know, Donald, President Trump saying, well, you know, the police shouldn't be too nice or something like that, you know, and all the, I think all the progress on this basically stopped for various Trumpian, Sessionian type of reasons, essentially.
Yeah. So, and we should explain, I guess, in a little detail the way these department investigations work, because this is a distinction I want to draw. Is the Justice Department essentially brings a civil suit against the city, the department, or whoever the official body is, regarding certain practices being unconstitutional, and then the city and the government reach some sort of agreement as to here are the steps we're going to take to remediate that, at which point they enter into essentially a settlement with the court, and the court records it on its books. And I think that's different, because in that case, we are talking about sort of a bigger collective conduct, right? And a civil suit, whereas in the Derek Chauvin case, you are necessarily, and quite properly, you're talking about an individual determination on an individual for an individual act.
Right.
So, I mean, I think to some extent, when we say, well, will the verdict change the way policing happens? And people say, well, no, this doesn't address everything. I think my response is, yeah, but it's not supposed to. This is necessarily how the justice system works, is you have a single defendant and he's tried on that single conduct based on that evidence in that case.
Yeah.
And it would be improper, to bring in other evidence, against him.
Yeah.
I just wanted to make that distinction.
You know, and you mentioned earlier legislation and referred to, I think, the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act, which was passed in the House in March. It actually had one Republican vote, but it turns out it was a guy who hit the wrong button.
Not really.
Exactly. Said whoops. But I think there's actually, you know, you mentioned Tim Scott being the Senate negotiator on this, and I think there actually is some basis for potentially for some sort of agreement here. For one thing, it seems like there's general agreement that chokehold should be banned at the federal level, and there should be maybe some sort of disincentive in terms of funding for state and local agencies that permit the use of chokehold, so they would lose federal funding, essentially.
Sure.
There's also, I think, similarly agreement on the problematic nature of no-knock warrants, on the usefulness of body cameras, on issues with giving local police agencies too much military-style weaponry, and even, you know, on the positive nature of some of these investigations. So I think all of these things, the Republicans tend to have much more of a carrot than a stick sort of approach to that, if you will. It's kind of spinning it in a positive way for Republicans. But it seems to me that the big issue that you mentioned is that qualified immunity issue. And just to be clear for listeners, that qualified immunity doesn't refer to criminal trial. So it wouldn't be like in the Chauvin case. This is only this doctrine that shields government officials, including police, from being held personally liable in civil cases for these violations.
Actions taken within the scope of their duty.
Yeah. And there's a lot of case law behind this, but basically the Supreme Court has said that the only way to overcome this qualified immunity defense is to show that the conduct that the defendant engaged in, well, the words are, violated clearly established statutory or constitutional rights, which a reasonable person would have known. And on the face of that, that sounds reasonable. But in practice, what it means, what it's meant to this point, is that qualified immunity is granted unless there's an earlier decision by a federal court in that jurisdiction or the Supreme Court that essentially holds that the exact same conduct under the exact same circumstances was ruled to be illegal or unconstitutional. I mean, there are some crazy cases about this, Jay. You got
that totally right.
You know, that was really good.
That was going to be my lawyer answer.
Well, thank you. You
kind of beat me to it.
But I mean, there are some wild cases. Like, for instance, there was a police officer who shot a 10-year-old kid while trying to shoot a dog who was just being a dog. And the 11th Circuit said, well, the officer is entitled to qualified immunity because no previous case said it was unconstitutional for a police officer to recklessly fire his gun into a group of children without justification.
Right. No one has ever determined that this is a constitutional violation on a Tuesday.
Exactly.
And this case completely happened on a Tuesday. So, yeah, we don't have any precedent to go on.
Yeah. So
I'm exaggerating.
Yeah.
But I think states it pretty well. And there is a hesitancy. Again, most all of these cases are brought. I shouldn't say that. But often they can be brought in state courts, and there is a reluctance to the expansion of sovereign immunity. I think in a lot of places, it kind of makes sense because the sovereign is reluctant to expand it. The other side, I could argue. I don't know, but we've talked about this before, but I've actually been in these situations, filing 1983 claims against police officers and police departments, and have run into exactly that issue that you're talking about. Really looks pretty unconstitutional, but it's not exactly the same as this other case you're looking at. But the other problem, of course, is that municipalities are deep pockets, and there are plenty of people who have encounters with the police that don't go well, or at least they don't feel they go well. It could be something of a lottery ticket type mentality. And I think that's what a lot of municipalities fear, that if these protections are weakened to the extent that there is no qualified immunity, you will see a raft of everyone who was arrested can make a claim saying, listen, I was my constitutional rights were violated. Give me money.
And I get that.
Out of the number of that, I think you'd see more settlements. And that's the concern.
Yeah. And I get that. And I think that's a fair concern, which is why I wouldn't support just ending qualified immunity. But it seems to me that you can have some sort of, reasonable person sort of standard that isn't as incredibly strict as we have. I mean, I'm sorry, if you're a police officer and you're firing into a group of children and you say, well, I have qualified immunity because there's been no case law on firing into a group of children, that's just wrong. You can craft a standard that singles out that sort of egregious, pretty obviously wrong behavior that any reasonable police officer should have known was wrong without destroying qualified immunity.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. It's just finding the language to do that.
Yeah.
I will also note that, typically Democrats have been more friendly to the trial bar.
Sure.
And that there is a potential if qualified immunity were eliminated, which I don't think it will be. And keep in mind, in many cases, it's state qualified immunity. Right, where that you're looking at the state statutes, and different state statutes spell out qualified immunity a little bit differently. So it's not like they're all the same, and there's one national standard. But I think the way you put it, it pretty much catches the bulk of everyone.
I mean, I feel like people respond to incentives, both positive and negative, and if police officers, government officials in general who have a certain amount of authority, especially if they're carrying, weapons, I think it's good for them to know that, hey, I can't just do whatever I want and know that the government is going to have my back and I am not going to have to worry about anything unless I murder somebody, essentially. I think it's important for that knowledge to be there that, hey, if I go over the line, no one's going to have my back, and they shouldn't have my back. So I better stay within, within reasonable standards of my profession. And I've said a bunch of times, and I took some heat on from listeners on this last week, saying that I don't think the problem is that, the issue is that we should defund the police. I think the problem is that we need to set standards and compensation higher. We need to demand more of our police, and that includes a lot more accountability.
Yeah. This is maybe getting a little off, but by chance, I scheduled a lunch with a good friend of mine, another BW graduate, who is a police chief. He's been police chief in a Cleveland suburb for 15 years now. And it just happened that we had lunch the day after the Chauvin verdict. And I got his perspective on it, and I'd love to have him on the show sometime because it was fascinating. And he sort of said exactly what you did, and sort of in some other tweaks that people don't think about in terms of policing. And he described it as it's a craft, and it takes years and years to learn this craft. And in some ways, there's a weird disconnect because it's, on one hand, a blue collar job, but on the other hand, it calls for some pretty significant high level decision making and significant people skills and so forth. One of his recommendations was, it was a weird tweak. And again, this would vary from state to state, but in Ohio, you can't become a police officer until you're 21. And you have a lot of kids who graduate at 18. If there are a way to catch those kids and put them into a pre-vocational program, right? That maybe they don't want to go to a four-year college. They can get experience and move forward. And then when they're 21, they are ready to be a police officer. Because once you get kids past 21 who have the college degree, a lot of them don't want to be a police officer anymore. And the other thing he mentioned was the difficulty in finding good and qualified candidates. And he said that his department and many departments really struggle with that. And it's only getting more difficult. Because look, the incentives at this point, are not great.
I think it's important to think about is that we're asking in many cases, and I think rightly so, saying to these folks, we are going to literally demand that you have a camera on you at all times. If I wore a body cam throughout my day and my activity, I mean, that would be pretty stressful in and of itself. And so what we are demanding more and more, and again, I think rightly so, but representing the government walking around with guns and tasers and so, I want these to be incredibly well-trained, well-motivated people who feel good about their jobs and aren't stressed yeah. about financial or other things. And so that's why I think that we need to pair these. I'm just so adamant on this that we need far more accountability, but we can't just have that accountability and say, well, we're not going to compensate you for all the things we're asking you to do and be. That's just doesn't follow to me at all.
Yeah.
But you know, one other thing that we didn't talk about yet that you mentioned in the open were the remarks made by Maxine Waters and by Representative Waters and President Biden. And I feel like President Biden's remarks are, that's not really a big deal. He specifically waited until the jury was sequestered and, you know, same. Now, Maxine Waters has a long history. I know she's one of your favorites.
Certainly. One of my favorites, yes. Long get in time. Their face. Get, yes, yeah.
But, you know, and yeah, I certainly thought that that was inappropriate. I don't think it rises to the level of grounds of appeal. You'll certainly, everyone has their right to state their opinions about that. It means a lot more if that opinion comes from if Joe Biden during the trial had said, by God, if they don't find Chauvin guilty, there's going to be blood in the streets and I'm okay with that. Well, that would be one thing, right? Maxine Waters, who, I mean, that's not that big of a deal. I don't think it's really grounds for appeal or anything like that. I certainly don't think she should have been. I think
it's grounds for appeal. Yeah. I don't know that it would be a successful
appeal. There you
appeal.
Go. Okay, fair
but
enough.
But it's certainly grounds for it.
Yeah, fair enough, yeah. And, you know, I think it's funny seeing someone like what Marjorie Taylor Greene saying, well, she should be expelled from Congress. Like, okay, yeah, you know, the person saying, well, we should, you know, shoot Nancy Pelosi in the head or something like that, you know. But yeah.
Well, stop clocks right twice a day. Yeah, so, I mean, yeah, you know.
But yeah, and I think that's, you know, I think it is inappropriate for people with a position of public trust to make sort of, and I know that some people were saying, well, she just meant to, you know, yell louder when you protest or something. It seemed to me that was pretty clear what she was saying. And I had a problem with it, certainly.
Yeah. Well, good. I mean, and to me, it's, I'm very troubled when a politician or anyone with a loud voice in media warns a jury about reaching the wrong verdict. That's problematic, and that shows a lot of disrespect for the justice system and the jury system, and really puts those jurors at potential risk. And given what I can't think that there's anyone on that jury who, I mean, obviously they're all residents of Minneapolis. They all saw what happened last year, long before they were put on a jury. And I think they all understood what would have happened if they had reached a different verdict. And the fact that you have a member of Congress who is going out there and essentially this sort of saber rattling of, look, you get this right, or there's going to be, I mean, when she says more confrontational, I don't know what what exactly does she mean by that, if not violence and the, you know, the stay in the streets. Do I think it rises to the level of a mistrial? Probably not. But what it does do is it takes away from the certainty that we would have that this conviction was solely on the facts and the evidence.
Sure. And that, I should point out.
I think, in this case, we're fortunate because this was so public. So many people saw so much of the evidence. Again, you know, we didn't see what the jury saw, and we saw more than the jury saw. But I think most people can have a high degree of confidence that that was the right verdict.
Well, you know, but
in a closer case,
we're focusing a lot on Maxine Waters, but I think it's important to point out that somebody who has a much bigger audience and far more influence than Maxine Waters has ever or will ever have is Tucker Carlson. And Tucker Carlson said on Fox News after the verdict was announced that the jury in the Derek Chauvin trial came to a unanimous and unequivocal verdict this afternoon. Please don't hurt us. Yeah. Tucker Carlson is a reprehensible human being for a lot of reasons. Maybe he's nice in his private life, loves dogs, and is wonderful to his, I don't know if he's married, wife or kids or something like that. But this is the sort of thing, that makes me almost physically ill. And I would, you know, so you're saying, well, there's a lot of clear evidence, but yeah, there are plenty of millions of people who follow Tucker Carlson, who's become sort of like the Sean Hannity of the post-Trump age, so to speak, and would say, yeah, see, this was, you know, Chauvin, you know, maybe went a little far, but this jury wasn't, you know, and I would hope that you would also find that to be pretty reprehensible.
Oh, I do. Okay. Yeah.
I just wanted to point out that this works both ways, you know, on this. And
But the distinction I would draw, and again, I agree, Tucker Carlson, that whole pitch is reprehensible. And there was a really good piece, and I'm trying to think whether it was in Jonah Goldberg's new outlet or if it was in National Review. But sort of, you know, putting Tucker Carlson and Maxine Waters kind of side by side.
Sure.
And condemning them both.
Yeah.
So the distinction that I would draw, though, is that Tucker Carlson's statements, reprehensible as they were, came after a decision.
Right.
And there was no risk that he would sort of somehow infect the jury pool or improperly weigh in on their deliberations.
No, that's a reasonable distinction to make. So, yeah. You know, so before we move on to our next story, what do you think about the prospects of some sort of legislative action, some sort of compromise on this? There are a lot of folks on my side of the aisle who are hoping to get that George Floyd Act or some version of it passed by the first anniversary of Floyd's death. And I think it was the 25th, I believe the 25th of May, I think is the date. And I don't know that that's going to happen, but do you think that Tim Scott is doing all this work for nothing, you know,
yes, I do. Yeah.
That's kind of my sense too, is that I think even though there is the potential, there are clearly a lot of things both sides agree on. I think unfortunately that both sides are much more interested in having an issue to run on than actually doing anything. But that said, I also think that this is one area where the Biden administration, Justice Department, can do an awful lot of good. And it looks like they're going to sort of be moving in that direction. And so I still think we'll be able to see some positive changes, despite what I expect will be a lack of congressional action on this.
Yeah, no, I agree. I don't think any congressional action.
Unfortunately. All right. Well, Jay, before we get to our next story, we just need to take a quick break and we will be right back. Okay, Jay.
Moving on our next, story, Mike, it's Happy Earth Day from a couple days ago. I hope you enjoyed it. As part of that Earth Day, President Biden announced that his pledge to cut U.S. emissions in half of the 2005 levels by 2030. Now, he hasn't made any real plans how exactly we'll do that, but this joins with other countries who have made similar new pledges over the last week regarding their emissions cuts. China, I think, notably said they will have peak emissions, I think, by 2025 and then start going down from there, which doesn't sound great, saying we're going to keep increasing emissions for the next couple of years. But you know, companies, in addition, you wanted to point this out, that have made their own, you know, net zero emissions pledges by certain dates. And I, you know, I'll turn this to you, because my thoughts are this is very much a lot of show and not much substance. But I know we had a pretty strong disagreement a couple of years ago when President Trump pulled out of the Paris Climate Accords, which no one has followed. So where do you think we are on Earth Day and the welcoming back of the U.S. By the other by the global community on climate issues?
Well, I think you're right in the sense that, you know, Joe Biden can promise whatever he wants, but without any sort of legislative action, it doesn't amount to a whole lot. Even if we have a number of corporations, big corporations in some cases, you know, pledging these net zero standards, that sort of thing, or, you know, car companies saying that we're going to move to no emission vehicles by X date, that's good. I don't think it's enough, but we do see a lot of models in other countries where this actually has happened. For instance, there are currently 46 countries that have some form of carbon pricing or carbon tax. And this originally in the United States actually was an idea that came from the right as kind of a market-based way.
Right. Way back in like the late 80s. Yes.
I mean, even China recently rolled out a national emissions trading program. Now, it's super small at this point, but there are a lot. You know, the EU has this, Japan, Korea, Canada, Mexico, the UK. So there is a model here for doing this, even in a market-based sort of way. And that to me is encouraging, that not only is there a model, but it's been adopted by a lot of countries. And I don't see any reason why this formerly conservative idea that the right has seemed to have abandoned couldn't be something that could be a step that we could take here in the United States.
It all depends on, that's maybe one way to do it. I'm not sure, though. If you look at these other countries that have had carbon taxes, to what extent has it really impacted their emissions? I guess that's, you know, U.S. emissions have been on a downward trajectory. And again, excluding 2020, which is, you know, bizarre for a whole bunch of other reasons, but have been on a downward trajectory, largely in result to more shift to natural gas. But you know, and just higher efficiency, and I don't know that does this really help emissions, or is it just another tax?
It helps the question, because as a conservative, I would think an article of faith for you is, you know, if you tax something, you get less of it. So if you tax, you know, any kind of activity, you're going to get less of it. That, depending on where you set the tax rate. So, of course, if you tax carbon, you're going to get less of it.
Yeah.
So, and the question
the other,
is...
I mean, the other piece, though, that's it's a little more complicated, is that so much of carbon, which we use for energy, fuels the rest of the economy, which allows us to make these other technological advancements. So if you're going to, you know, keep reducing your carbon input, at some point you also reduce, unless we find some other really workable form of energy, you're also reducing the economic growth that can fuel the improvements, that can pay for all the building fix-ups, that can pay for the green infrastructure projects.
And see, to me, that sounds like you not trusting the market, because
my concern is that the market would work all too well here.
No, what I'm saying is that what we've seen in so many areas is when these environmental standards are set, industry at first says, "Oh my God, we can't do that. That's going to mean that the cost of a new car is going to be $100,000, and people are going to be just dying in the streets because we're going to have to make them out of balsa wood or something like that." But industry has found a way to meet these targets, and so to me, actually, a really a really positive way forward is for the government, the federal government, to say, here are some overall targets we're going to set, or here is a market for emissions we're going to set up with overall targets. And we're going to let the market figure out how to do that, as opposed to some very granular sort of regulation that oftentimes you can just find a million and one loopholes to get through.
Oh, no, of those two approaches that you're describing, no, the second is very much the better. But if you look at something like,
you mean the first,
for example,
one.
vehicle CAFE standards, right?
Yeah.
We talked about this almost maybe a year or so ago. In large part, what companies are doing is they're taking the bulk of sales on one product, the bad product, and then funneling it into subsidies for another one in order to keep their average, within
average,
the bounds that they're supposed to. And look, is that really working? My sense is no. And also, this is something I sort of hinted at a couple weeks ago, but I always like to make the point when people talk about zero emissions vehicles. There's really no such thing, unless you happen to live in a place that receives its electricity, from fully nuclear or solar or wind or something like that. Even there, there's emissions and costs associated with putting those pieces in place. But look, the most conservative law ever, Mike, is the law of conservation of matter and energy. And your electricity comes from somewhere. And if the emissions aren't coming out of your car, they may well be coming out of a coal-fired power plant that's making the electricity to charge your car.
Sure. The point is there are cleaner and dirtier forms of emission. And everyone having their own internal combustion engine in their vehicle is less clean and less good for the environment than everyone charging their electric cars. Because power plants are going to be cleaner than the millions of individual internal combustion engines people have in their vehicles. That's just a fact.
I don't know.
No, it's you can disagree with
it.
It's a fact.
Mike says it's a fact.
It's a fact. But I understand what you're saying, and I think that oftentimes the debate and the discussion, at least from the left, on this can be a little too one-sided. It tends to focus on cutting emissions, and I think that's absolutely has to be a critical part of it. And I'm glad that the left focuses so much on that. But the other side of that, I think, has to be looking at things that oftentimes are really uncomfortable to folks on the left. And one of those things, I'll use it, dirty word, geoengineering. I think that we don't put nearly enough money into geoengineering. In fact, the first time I believe there was any U.S. government subsidy for this was in 2019. I believe the NOAA got like $4 million, not billion, but $4 million to study geoengineering ideas. That is such a pittance. And I'm not saying that, I've seen Snowpiercer, I'm not saying that we should just start just throwing stuff randomly into the atmosphere. But I think the idea that we're going to be able to get to where we need to get to by just cutting output is just wildly naive. And that certainly has to be part of the solution. But unless we can find ways to control, ideally minimize the carbon in the atmosphere, and also unless we can focus more on another dirty word to many people on the left, nuclear.
That was the one I thought you were going to use in the first place.
Yeah, no, I really think that we have to look at all of these things. And if we don't include all of these things, we're just shooting ourselves in the foot. So I certainly think the left has part of the solution, but there are other parts that I wish that, my fellow Democrats would focus a little bit more on. And again, geoengineering and nuclear, I think they have to be part of the solution. And not only that, but we want to make sure that, that in these technologies, and that geoengineering is going to be a major focus in a lot of countries. Do we really want to be behind, say, China on geoengineering if it can become a multi-trillion-dollar industry? I think not. So that, to me, it just makes good kind of economic and strategic sense as well.
Well, my sense is the Chinese would not be big into geoengineering, because if it solves the carbon problem, that's no help to them.
No, I think it is, because if you take a look at, that's the thing, the negative externalities of all of this pollution, of all of this climate change. They affect China in a huge way. China has 20% of the world's...
I understand they affect China in a huge way. Do you think they affect President Xi in a huge way?
Absolutely. They, I mean, that he breathes the same air in, you know, in China that
I'm
other
sure
people
he does.
So absolutely, they have a huge interest in doing things that can mitigate carbon without mitigating economic growth. If they can do that, wow, that's a huge thing. So absolutely, absolutely.
So when you pitched that we were going to talk about this, my first thought was to jump to sort of a David Letterman top 10 list of top 10 ways the Russians and the Chinese are going to cut their emissions. And, you know, was thinking things like all tanks for the Ukraine invasion will be hybrid.
Yeah.
You know, cut the heating to the Xinjiang concentration camps. In terms of what other countries are doing and can we count on their cooperation, I think the answer is no.
See, I think
Russia and China see this as a strategic play. I don't think they have any intention of abiding by any of this. They just hope that we do, and they hope we're suckers.
Well, see, and I think that's fundamentally wrongheaded, because it's like saying, well, you know, we're all in this one big boat and there are a whole bunch of holes on our end and there are a whole bunch of holes on your end. Well, we're going to patch the holes on our end. And the people on the other end are saying, well, ha ha ha, what suckers. We're not going to patch the holes on our end. Well, it's the same boat and it's going to go down. So, no, I think for many other issues, yeah, but this is the one planet we're all on. And unless you just dismiss, you know, the science on this, then I think that it's hard to not come to the conclusion that something has to be done. And sure, you know, there are plenty of countries who say, I hope that the U.S. does more than its fair share. But the idea that you can just do nothing when you have 28% of the world's emissions and expect the world to be fine, that would suggest that the Chinese leadership is incredibly, insanely stupid. And it may be a lot of things, but it's not that.
Oh, we can talk about this forever, but look, my sense is the Chinese and the Russians have typically never been interested in the well-being of the rest of the world. The political regimes that have historically over the last century run those two countries have been interested in their own preservation and their own comfort. And their own power, and I think they would continue to do this. And I don't see why the Chinese with a booming economy would say, look, we're going to kneecap our economy, because
but I think you're missing my
really
point.
Concerned.
You're missing my point. I'm saying that would suggest then that there would be a huge incentive for the Chinese and anyone else to find ways to deal with the effects of climate change that don't kneecap the economy. And what I'm saying is that geoengineering and nuclear are two ways where you can potentially not necessarily lower energy usage, but have that same level of energy usage and not decrease economic activity and not contribute to climate change. And who wouldn't want that? You'd have to be a moron not to want that.
Wow. Well, I guess you just have a whole lot more faith in
time
some
out,
of these,
time
other,
so you're saying,
these other nations than I do.
You're saying to me that if you're saying to me that the Chinese, you think they're saying, well, there might be a way where we could get in at the front of a multi-trillion dollar industry, be the world leader, where we could not have to cut our economic input, but we could also contribute to or not create more global, you know, more of these greenhouse gases and other things, that they would say, well, that's nothing we want to do. That's nothing we're interested in. That makes no sense.
Well, you're assuming
logic?
That there is this multi-trillion dollar industry that,
there
I mean, look,
be.
If
I'm not saying
if,
there
if
is,
this, if this was, if this was so lucrative, right? Why haven't people been doing it before?
Well, people are starting to do it. And in fact, people are doing it. It is being done. It's in the early stages, certainly, but that's the time to kind of jump in and get the, you know, and get the, take the lead position, essentially. You know, that's why, for instance, China and a lot of other countries are doing a lot of stuff in solar and other renewables that, you know, the United States used to be clearly head of the pack on this, but we've fallen back in a lot of these things. So it's not like this stuff isn't happening. It's not like the Chinese say, you know, the hell with the environment. We don't care about that. They clearly do.
Yes, I think that's exactly what the Chinese say.
No, not at all.
I shouldn't say
you're saying the Chinese are monsters who don't care about the environment, but we're wonderful people who do.
Yeah, I would say the President Xi, the heads of the Chinese Communist Party don't care about the environment.
Not at all. They're saying, like, it would be awesome if we just destroyed the environment and the world were unlivable in 100 years.
Yeah, I think if they said as long as we're in charge, I think they'd be okay with that.
China's leaders don't have the basic humanity that our leaders do.
Yes.
Okay.
I'm saying that.
So they're monsters. Would you say they're subhuman?
Perhaps. Yeah.
Wow.
I mean, if you're putting a ethnic minority in concentration camps and killing them and forcibly sterilizing them, yeah.
Sure. They do some awful things. Absolutely. But you're saying, I mean, what you're saying is,
but they're really good for the environment.
That's a different category of thing because that's a different boat. I mean, you can say that, well, you know, whatever happens to the Uyghurs or whatever, you know, that doesn't affect me. But the idea that these people would be so blind to say that, well, you know, the quality of the air, that doesn't affect me. I've seen those pictures. You've seen those pictures. And President Xi and everyone else has lived in those days where you look out and there's just this horrific haze over everything in Shanghai. And that's not that. So the idea that there was, oh, that doesn't matter to me. I think that's just completely wrong.
All right. Well,
all right.
I mean,
so,
we can.
Yeah. I think we have time for one more story. Before we get to that, let's just take our final quick break, and then we will come right back. Okay, Jay, it would be weird for us. It would be not weird, but I certainly would not want to go a whole episode without talking about at least one Supreme Court case, and we do have one, don't we?
We have two. Can I pick which one?
Absolutely.
we had two that we had talked about. Last week, a unanimous Supreme Court ruled against the FTC regarding its powers to essentially assess damages and reclaim funds. It was a $1.3 billion award that the FTC had originally gotten against a payday loan company that was engaged in some truly egregious things. And the unanimous court said, well, no, that's not what the statute says. The statute says you can have injunctive relief, meaning a court order telling them to stop. And it also includes other relief. But the other relief, the court reasoned, is dependent on the FTC doing some internal administrative actions first, and not just jumping straight to court to get the injunction. So I think this is interesting for a couple reasons. And the first being, it's a unanimous Supreme Court decision.
Yeah.
Now there are probably more of those than most people think. Right?
There are actually a lot more unanimous decisions than there are 5-4 decisions. Most people don't realize that because the unanimous ones don't get a lot of publicity. You know, but
right.
I think
it's
a lot of people.
It's the planes that land on time. Yeah.
Yep, exactly. You know, I thought it was interesting to me where in oral arguments, the attorney representing the FTC said, you know, yeah, we bring a lot more cases through court than we do through our administrative process, basically because it's a lot easier for us to do.
Right.
Even though the statute says nothing, it's clear that the statute doesn't give them authority. It gives them authority to seek a permanent injunction through the courts.
Right.
But not for these monetary damages, which is not to say that Scott Tucker didn't and his companies didn't do some, like you said, egregious things. And it's not even to say that the FTC can't initiate a process that would force the compensation to be made.
Yeah, they absolutely have the power to do that. Yeah.
They just didn't want to go to the hassle of doing it the long way, basically.
That's exactly right. So that's why I think this is a great decision.
Yeah.
And what I'll tell you, well, though, what troubles me, and I don't know, we didn't talk about this, but immediately thereafter, acting FTC chair Rebecca Kelly Slaughter slammed the ruling, saying the Supreme Court ruled in favor of scam artists and dishonest corporations, leaving average Americans to pay for illegal behavior.
Well, the first part of that is true.
That's pretty bold and
yeah.
To me, that strikes me as wow.
Well, the first part of it's true.
As someone like who litigates in court, right? There have been plenty of times when a decision didn't go my way, and rarely am I called upon to make a public statement about it, just because it's things that no one cares about. But you know, the typical response was, you know, we respectfully disagree with the court. We think they got it wrong, and here's why. But to say that the court ruled for scam artists.
Well, it did. I mean, that first part, I think we need to separate that statement. Scott Tucker was a scam artist. The court ruled for Scott Tucker, the scam artist. Now, the court was right to rule for Scott Tucker, the scam artist. And that gets to the second part. And, you know, I think that FTC head was just, you know, was disappointed that now her agency is going to have to take the more arduous path to get relief for these people, or to petition Congress to change the law so that they can go to the courts more readily. And in fact, there's legislation pending along those lines. And, you know, whether that's a good or bad thing is immaterial, but it certainly will make life harder for the FTC. And I think so. She's right in that sense, that this definitely does make things harder for the FTC, and it does make it more difficult for them to get economic redress from scam artists to the people who were scammed. But to me, then, the solution to that is to say, well, Congress, pass a law explicitly granting us this authority, and it'll make it easier.
Oh, right. No, you're absolutely right. Yeah. And look, if Congress amended the statute and said the FTC has the power to seek monetary damages in federal court, then great. I don't have any particular issue on the policy piece of it.
Yeah.
You know, maybe, look, there's an argument that if it goes up through the administrative decision process, there's more fact finding, there's more expertise by the agency, all that kind of stuff, and all those are fine arguments, and you know, probably that's going to be the better route. You also run into deference issues and all that, but look, I see nothing. There's absolutely nothing wrong with saying I think Congress should amend the statute. What I take issue with, interstatement with, is the sort of the broadside against the court, saying the court ruled for scam artists.
Sure.
Not that we're disappointed that the court took a narrower view of this statute and will approach Congress and seek to expand it.
No, I hear what you're saying there, and it's the broader issue.
It's sort of saying the Supreme Court, this is something that bugs me about judicial reporting. And two, the way it's more often the left that handles this, and I'm not going to let the right off completely, because certainly Trump said some crazy, outrageous things about court decisions. But the sense is that courts, their job is to pick the good guy and the bad guy and then just rule for whichever one they like better.
Well, I think the modern right feels that every bit as much as the modern left. I agree with you on this, but I think that of the sort of the type of conservatives who more exemplified the Republican Party when you and I were coming up, there was more of a distinction. But now, pretty much uniformly on the right and the left, it's all about outcomes, and we don't really care how we get there. It's just as long as we get the decision we want. And both you and I bemoan that, me from the left and you from the right. So, yeah, this is definitely something that we agree on. And on that larger point, yeah, I think that response, the nature of her response, was disrespectful to the court and just is another example of people just trying to essentially question the legitimacy of the institution when they don't like the outcome.
Exactly. No, that's exactly my point, and that's exactly what troubles me. Because again, this was not it's not as if the court, and if you read the opinion, it's not as if they said, "Wow, this guy's really cool. We like him. We're ruling for him. Screw you, consumers." It's very much of, you know, just looking. Here's what the statute says. Here's what the powers that you were given, FTC. Here are the other powers that you have. Here's another way you could have done this.
Yeah.
You know, and So yeah, that's what I think is, and to me, what's also remarkable is that the FTC has been able to continue this practice for as long as it has.
Yeah, no kidding.
And this has been going on for nearly 30 years.
And no one thought to challenge them on this when it seems, wow, they could have, I agree. That's pretty strange to me, but there you go.
Yeah. So.
All right. Well, on that note of strong agreement, we will close today, but there's a bunch of things we didn't get a chance to talk about that we will get to on our midweek show, like Jay mentioned that other Supreme Court decision that wasn't unanimous about life without parole sentences for juvenile offenders, the House passing the D.C. statehood bill. And by the way, recently, a few days ago, 420, as Chuck Schumer called it, the unofficial marijuana holiday for the country. We'll talk a little bit about his plans and what we might see in terms of legalization or decriminalization, and maybe even some questions from listeners. And all of that will be on the midweek show. If you are a supporter, that should be in your feed by Wednesday morning. If you're not, well, you know how to become a supporter. Just go to patreon.com/politicsguys. And again, remember, if you can't afford to support the show, just send me an email, mike@politicsguys.com, and I will take care of that for you. And finally, it costs nothing, and it really helps us out if you subscribe to the show, leave ratings and reviews, and especially if you could share episodes on social media. That really does help us get the word out. A special thanks to our executive producers, Bruce Johnson, Wilma Moreno, Andra Masker, Daniel Toe, Chris Wilkerson, and Nathan Sosnowski. We'll be back with a new show next week. We hope you join us.